It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk to U.S. Representative Ron Kind to get his take on President Trump's budget proposal and how it could affect rural Wisconsin.
First, the U.S. Supreme Court announced today that it would take up Wisconsin's partisan redistricting case. The court also granted a stay requested by Attorney General Brad Schimmel so that the state doesn't have to redraw maps while the case is being considered. Here's an election law professor, Rick Hassan, from the University of California, Irvine.
It's the most important partisan gerrymandering case the court will have considered in at least a decade. And what the court decides in Wisconsin is likely to affect the entire country. I believe this is the last real opportunity for the Supreme Court to rein in partisan gerrymandering.
Sean Johnson joins us now. He's the Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio. Sean, thanks for coming in.
Hey, Veronica.
Well, Sean, why is this case, as we just heard, seen as being so important?
It's important both in Wisconsin and nationally. So, I mean, in Wisconsin, the reasons are pretty, apparent. You know, the map that we have right now on which legislators run, the way that we divvy up our state into 33 Senate districts, 99 Assembly districts, is being challenged in this case. And if it's struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court, the court would essentially be telling the legislature, you got to start over and you got to draw a map that's more competitive, that essentially gives Democrats a better chance to win. And then if you're looking at nationally, this is, this would be, if it were upheld, the first time the U.S. Supreme Court had upheld a partisan gerrymandering lawsuit. And so what that means is you'd see lawsuits like the one that was filed in Wisconsin filed all over the country. And that's particularly significant right now because you had a number of legislative maps that were drawn after the 2010 elections by Republicans in that year, 2011.
And Sean, there are other cases like this out there. Why did the Supreme Court take the Wisconsin case over all of those?
Yeah, so there are a lot. I mean, redistricting cases are pretty normal. You know, you can almost bank on it that when there's a legislative plan enacted or any kind of redistricting dispute, it's going to go to federal court. A federal court redistricting challenge automatically gets appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. So, you know, that's not unusual. Typically, though, when those cases are brought, they're brought on different grounds. Maybe a racial gerrymandering case is a pretty common one, for example. This is a partisan gerrymandering case. And so essentially what it's saying or what it's challenging is what everybody kind of knows exists out there but isn't quite sure how to measure it. So it's saying that in Wisconsin's case, there was too much partisanship, that Wisconsin was sort of the poster child for how much is too much when it comes to partisan gerrymandering cases.
And in other news, we mentioned a bit earlier, the court also granted a stay to stop the requirement to redraw the legislative maps that was supposed to have been done by a lower court by November 1st. What do you read into that?
It's a significant ruling because, you know, that may not be the way that this case ends up. You know, we don't know how the U.S. Supreme Court is going to rule in Wisconsin's case. But by granting that stay that was requested by Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel, a Republican, what the U.S. Supreme Court has done is said we're going to keep the Republican-drawn legislative maps in place while this case proceeds. And what that means practically, at least according to the experts that I've talked to, is that it makes it more likely that those Republican-drawn maps will be in place for the 2018 election cycle. So why is that significant? Well, you know, every election cycle, every election is significant, but some of the senators that get elected next year will be senators who are drawing maps in the next round of redistricting potentially. So, it's kind of one of those cases, one of those issues that goes on and on.
Does that indicate to you that stay on that decision that the wind may be blowing in a certain direction, maybe in the GOP's favor at this point?
I mean, there's a couple schools of thought on that. One school of thought is that you have on the court five justices who are potentially willing to believe the GOP side of things here, that one reason that you grant a stay, one reason among many, is that you might think that, one side has a chance of winning on appeal. In this case, it could be a sign that Supreme Court justices, five of them, think that Republicans will win this case on appeal. That might not be why they're doing it, though. They might think, well, we don't want to disrupt things while this case proceeds, so let's keep things on hold. We don't know if we don't know how we're going to rule in this case, so let's not be too disruptive while we decide that. So you can read into it, but it's not good for the plaintiffs. They wanted to get this map out of here. The Democratic plaintiffs have brought the case, but we don't know exactly what it's going to mean for the case itself.
Sean Johnson is with us, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief, and we're talking about the news today that the U.S. Supreme Court has decided to take up Wisconsin's partisan redistricting case. And Sean, the lower court agreed that Wisconsin's voting maps amounted to unconstitutional partisan gerrymandering. They agreed with the challengers. What did they say?
Yeah, so that was a 2-1 decision that was issued last year. And when these redistricting cases go through federal court, they go to 3-judge federal panels. In this case, the judge who wrote the decision that struck down Wisconsin's Republican-drawn legislative map was a appointee of President Ronald Reagan. The judge who joined him was a Democratic appointee. The judge who dissented in that case was a Republican appointee. But you had a Republican and a Democratic appointee who decided that Wisconsin's maps amounted to an unconstitutional partisan gerrymander that silenced the voices of Democratic voters, that made it impossible for them to influence, the legislative majorities in Wisconsin just because of their political belief. You know, it had shut them out of the process because of their political beliefs. And that Wisconsin, while it's a closely divided state in statewide elections, like for president or for governor, that closely divided nature was not reflected in races for the legislature, where Republicans had maintained or grown their majorities.
And we're going to hear a little bit from Paul Smith now of the Campaign Legal Center. Sean, if you could tell us a little bit about Paul Smith.
Paul Smith is the lead attorney for the Campaign Legal Center, which is carrying this case for Democratic plaintiffs who are challenging it. And he said this is a really significant case nationally.
The court has always felt like a certain amount of politics is tolerable. You've got to give us a test that tells us which ones go too far. And in this case, we're dealing with a really extreme and largely undisputed partisan gerrymander in Wisconsin, one of the worst in modern history.
So one of the things you heard Paul Smith allude to there is kind of why they chose Wisconsin to bring this case. I mean, there are partisan gerrymanders in other parts of the country, but they feel like as part of their test for the court, plaintiffs wanted to have a proof of intent. You know, they wanted to be able to tell the court there was an intent to create this partisan advantage. And there was this lengthy factual record in Wisconsin's case showing that when Republicans drew up these maps, they chose the most Republican skewed map over a variety of other alternatives that would have satisfied, you know, other constitutional requirements of redistricting.
And Sean, Justice Anthony Kennedy is seen as being particularly pivotal in this case. Why him in particular?
So back in 2004, the last time the court really dug into this idea of whether or not it can get involved in partisan redistricting cases, they had a 4-4 split basically on the court. 4 justices who said, yeah, we need to get involved in this case. 4 justices who said, you know, this isn't our place. And Justice Kennedy in the middle, who said, okay, we shouldn't get involved in this 2004 case, this Pennsylvania case, but in the future, the court should be open to partisan gerrymandering claims if somebody can come up with a workable standard for how we measure when partisanship gets too partisan. And so what you've got in the Wisconsin case is essentially plaintiffs have, from day one, been building this case to appeal to Justice Anthony Kennedy. And, you know, we still don't know how he's going to rule in this case. The court has a lot of new members, but it's similarly divided, kind of 4-4 with Justice Kennedy in the middle.
And so just briefly, is part of this case going to be whether there is a perceivable, workable standard to measure partisan gerrymandering?
Yeah, they're going to have to look at that. I mean, one of the things that plaintiffs have developed in this case is something called, they call it the efficiency gap, which looks at what they say call wasted votes. So these are votes that Democrats cast for, you know, in Wisconsin's case, Democrats cast when they don't need to in a heavily Democratic district or districts where Democrats come up just short in a losing effort. And the higher the efficiency gap, the higher the gerrymander. In Wisconsin's gerrymander, according to the political scientists who studied it and testified in court, Wisconsin's gerrymander is one of the most severe of any ever drawn over the last 40 years.
And Sean, as we wrap up, what is a timeline for this case? When could we feasibly expect some kind of a verdict?
So we don't know exactly. We know that the court's going to lay out a briefing schedule here soon. The court could hear oral arguments by late this year or early next year. So, you know, you might be looking in the realm of December, possibly. The court is almost certainly to rule on this case by June of next year. So, you know, what that means for the maps next year, we're not exactly sure. Experts say it's unlikely that the map's going to get swished before next November's election, but there is that possibility.
Sean, thanks a lot for coming in and sharing with us today.
You're welcome.
That was Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief, joining us to talk about news today that the U.S. Supreme Court has decided to take up Wisconsin's partisan redistricting case.
Coming up, we'll talk to U.S. Representative Ron Kind. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, it's been over 70 years since World War II ended. Our guests say Americans have forgotten the consequences of a major global catastrophe, and that puts us at risk for another one.
Right now, U.S. Representative Ron Kind of La Crosse says President Trump's budget is bad for rural Wisconsin. I talked to him on Friday to find out more. Congressman Kind, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Big picture, what does President Trump's proposed budget do when it comes to rural Wisconsin, rural America?
Well, it's really surprising. Given where his political support came from last year, you'd think that his budget would be more sensitive to the needs of rural Wisconsin, rural America. But by looking at it and what he's proposing, it's almost a declaration of war against rural America, with the deep spending cuts that he's proposing in his budget on vitally important programs that partner with rural local communities to help them be more successful. And it really doesn't make any sense. So obviously I and others within the rural caucus in Congress are pushing back hard on this, and hopefully we'll have some influence with him and his administration.
Let's get into some specific areas. Now, one of your biggest concerns, I know, was in cuts to the USDA. What are some of the areas that you see important cuts in?
Yeah, first of all, he's proposing a 21% cut to the Department of Agriculture. And with that comes zeroing out all economic development rural grant money. And those are grants partnering with local communities to help start up businesses, business incubators, projects that they want to start at a local level to help create good-paying jobs. It also eliminates funding for telehealth services for health care needs in rural areas. It eliminates funding for rural airports, the essential air service. And, of course, we've got a few of them here in rural Wisconsin that are dependent upon it. The manufacturing extension program. This is run out of our extension programs at the universities. They partner with local manufacturers to help them to become more lean and efficient and therefore more competitive globally to keep those manufacturing jobs right in rural areas throughout Wisconsin and the rest of the country. But what's also problematic, Rob, is a severe reduction in low-interest operating loans for family farmers. If anyone knows how family farmers have to operate their business, it's capital-intensive. They got to take revolving or operating loans throughout the year to make ends meet. You eliminate those low-interest programs on them, it's going to make the cost of them doing business much greater at a time when commodity prices and milk prices are really low. And it could be enough to break many of them. So there's a lot of work to do to improve upon the first Trump budget and make it more sensitive to the needs of rural America.
Another program that you cited in a press release is the value-added grant. This is not necessarily a household name, but I know over the years Wisconsin farming advocates have said this is an important program to help farmers, instead of selling low-cost commodities, sell some kind of refined goods out of their commodities.
Yeah, you know, that was based on my dairy action plan that I released this week, this month, being June Dairy Days here in Wisconsin. But, you know, the dairy industry is getting pounded right now. Our dairy producers are looking at the third year of really low milk prices. One of the things that we've worked hard to get into the Farm Bill is this value-added marketing program. So we're doing a better job of matching the dairy products that are being made to the consumer choices and what the consumers are demanding. And with the excess supply of milk and dairy that we have in the market right now, we've got to think of creative ways to clear that market. You either do that by exporting more dairy products, and I've been leaning forward and trying to expand export markets and reduce those trade barriers and non-tariff barriers that make it hard for us to export our agriculture products, but also a way to try to increase domestic consumption. And you do this through that value-added marketing program.
There have been concerns over the years that the agriculture budget in the United States, the Farm Bill, creates incentives maybe for overproduction of certain commodities. There's room for cuts. Is there room for changes to farm spending that could involve some substantial cuts?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as a representative of one of the larger agriculture producing districts in the nation, I have been one of the loudest voices for reforming these so-called Title I subsidy programs. These are taxpayer-subsidized programs going primarily to a few but very large agribusinesses and not to the family farmers who might need some assistance. It hasn't worked for our family farms. It's leading to more consolidation in production agriculture, driving up land values, distorting the market, and ultimately it's not fiscally responsible to the American taxpayer. So I've been reforming that, trying to get more means testing in these programs, apply some limits and some caps as far as how much in subsidy payments a farm entity can receive. But also, you know, reforming the crop insurance program, because I think there's areas of tightening that up as well. I'm a big believer in risk management tools. Crop insurance is a risk management tool that we need to keep going. But the way it's structured right now, you literally can't even track the money of premium subsidy payments and who it's going to, because it's prohibited under current law. First of all, I think that's wrong. All money that the federal government spends should be accountable to the American taxpayer. But also, we're guaranteeing the crop insurance companies a 14% profit margin on the plans that they're issuing, and they bear very little risk. And five of the largest crop insurance companies we have in America today, by the way, are foreign-owned. So why are we guaranteeing this business, unlike any other business in the country, a 14% profit margin, not asking them to assume more risk, and expect this to make sense for the taxpayer? So there are certainly areas in the Farm Bill that we can tighten up and reform and yet still make it responsive to the needs of our family farmers back home.
We're talking to Wisconsin Congressman Ron Kind about the president's proposed budget and how it would affect rural Wisconsin and rural America in general. Congressman Kind, the president wants to take this budget and use a good chunk of money to leverage both public and private spending on infrastructure. Wouldn't that potentially benefit rural areas and maybe balance out some of these cuts?
Well, I was hoping that, you know, a major infrastructure reinvestment program, which is long overdue for America and Wisconsin, is something that we can reach bipartisan agreement on and work on this year. You know, Lord knows we have to start rebuilding America, rebuilding Wisconsin, and the infrastructure that we need to sustain long-term growth. I'm worried, however, with his idea of just doing this through the code, through tax-exempt bonding issues, working with private investors. Again, from my rural perspective, it's going to be very hard to attract that type of private investment, private capital into rural areas where the rate of return, the rate on that investment is very minimal, if non-existent. I mean, these private investors, whether they're private equity companies or VC companies, are going to be more interested in the larger urban projects that they can toll, that they can figure out a way to get money from those using the system. And it's just hard to do that in rural America. So there's a long ways that I think the president's plan needs to go in order to address the unique challenges and the special needs that we do have here in rural Wisconsin.
This is, of course, a presidential budget outline, and it's not a done deal. What do you see happening in Congress when it comes to rural priorities?
Well, fortunately, even a lot of my Republican friends said that not only was this budget dead on arrival, it was dead before arrival, because it was so unrealistic in its spending expectations and cuts and where they were primarily applying the cuts. So we've got to find a better balance as far as the limited resources that we're responsible for. We've got to figure out a way to reinvest in America. Reinvest in these regions and communities that have lagged and have been left behind with the economic recovery that we've had for the last 6, 7, 8 years. And there are pockets of those that are still way behind where they should be as far as reaching their economic potential with the jobs that we want in these areas. So, again, as one of the leaders of the Rural Caucus in Congress these days, we're going to be, you know, yelling and screaming and making sure our voices are heard when it comes to budget deliberations, making sure that there's a little more balance and some key priorities that are met when it comes to the needs of these rural communities.
I want to switch gears for our last couple of minutes and ask about this this awful shooting at the Republican baseball practice. As the news started to come to you, what was your reaction to what was happening to your congressional colleagues?
Well, again, it was such a tragic and senseless shooting yet again in America, this time targeting members of Congress. And, of course, I knew many of those Republican players who were out there early in the morning practicing, and our first thought was over their safety, and then hearing what the casualties that were coming in. And they're still in our thoughts and prayers. Steve Scalise was a really nice guy, and you know, he's still got a long ways to go. He's on his third or fourth surgery right now, and there's considerable damage that was done with that bullet that he took. But, again, I think, and this happened in response to the shootings, there was a coming together in Congress where we had a nice bipartisan briefing to get more information of what happened and what steps can be taken to enhance security, but also an effort to tone down the political rhetoric. You know, yes, we're going to have debates. We're going to have arguments about policy and the future direction of our country, and all that is fair game for a democracy, but it really is incumbent on us office holders to set a higher standard of civility and decency in the words that we're choosing to employ out there to make our points. And I think there was a greater recognition this week coming out of this tragedy. I hope it can be sustained. Sometimes we just lapse back into old habits and practices, but it wasn't just Washington that had this. I mean, there was that UPS employee out in California that killed three people, and this is a constant phenomenon, all too real in America, given the prevalence of guns, that there are going to be these mass shootings from time to time. And I hope we can figure out a way to have a more rational and reason-based assessment of what steps we can take to better safeguard our safety in communities.
Congressman Kind, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That was U.S. Representative Ron Kind from La Crosse. He represents Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District. He joined us to share his thoughts on President Trump's budget plan and its impact on rural Wisconsin. World War II ended in 1945, 72 years ago. President Trump was born the next year, and his campaign opponent Hillary Clinton was born a year after that. The average U.S. senator born about 1956. Representative younger than that, the population at large younger still.
So for most American leaders and voters, there's no direct memory of the global catastrophe of World War II. And our next guests say that's an important fact and a very dangerous one. They say that the United States actively worked to avoid a global calamity for 7 decades because of the memory of World War II. And without that memory, we could be headed to a new worldwide disaster.
Hal Brands and Charles Edel joins us now. Their piece in Foreign Policy is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Hal Brands is a distinguished professor of global affairs at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. Hal, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And Charles Edel is an associate professor of strategy and policy at the U.S. Naval War College. Charles, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks very much for hosting us.
Well, Hal, let's start right after World War II. How did the memory of World War II and what happened there shape the American-led post-war effort in the following years and decades?
So I think what happened was that after World War II, there was a concerted effort on the part of U.S. policymakers and the U.S. political class writ large to deal with the conditions that had led to the rise of global conflict in the first place. And those conditions were largely associated with nationalistic economic policies that had fostered the slide into depression during the 1930s, and then a failure to maintain effective collective security arrangements, which led to the rise of Nazi Germany and Japan as threats to global peace. And so after World War II, American policymakers basically learned the lesson of never again, that they should never again allow these things to happen. And so many of the policies that we now take for granted, the pursuit of free trade agreements that benefit everyone, U.S. participation in security alliances that really ring the globe, were responses to the tragedy of World War II and the threat that it might happen again if strong measures were not taken.
And Charles, we've seen bad things, certainly wars, some international wars happened since World War II. But can you put the scope of World War II in context compared to what happened since then?
Sure. By no means did the order that the United States helped to engineer following World War II by those lessons that Hal was talking about preclude all conflict in the international system. The point, though, that we had made in the article is that by this conscious decision of the United States to play a global role and support a different type of system, you would suppress global conflict. You would stem in the bud, to a certain extent, local conflicts before they metastasized, before they got out of control. You would create the conditions for American interests to flourish around the world. So over the past 72 years, as you pointed out, in no way, shape, or form did war leave the landscape of American foreign policy. In fact, America was involved with multiple wars during that time. But what you did see was the concerted effort by the United States embedding itself with like-minded allies around the globe to prevent and stop the further spiraling and escalation of conflicts into growing into a much larger conflict itself.
And Hal, that so far is the context for this piece the two of you wrote. You wrote it because you're worried that we're forgetting lessons of World War II and we're drawing back from this effort to prevent the next global catastrophe. What signs do you see that we Americans are forgetting those lessons?
Well, I think it's the lessons not just of World War II, but the lessons of international relations going back millennia. And in fact, one of the points we make in the piece is that these catastrophic breakdowns of the international order have tended to be the rule rather than the exception over the centuries. And so it's extremely naive for us to think that we have somehow gotten past the possibility of tragedy on a global scale because human nature has changed, because it most certainly hasn't. The problem is that in many ways, American foreign policy has become a victim of its own success. American foreign policy has been so successful at creating a prosperous, relatively stable global order over the past several decades, but I think many Americans have forgotten precisely why it is we do these things in the first place, precisely why it is we have these alliances, for instance. And so some of the worrying signs I think that we've seen in recent years are sort of representative of a growing American ennui with globalism. And so you can certainly see this with the fact that the United States elected as its president, someone who has expressed open disdain for American alliances. You can certainly see it in the fact that the U.S. defense budget has declined at the fastest rate since the Korean War over the past several years. And there are other signs as well. But we think of these kind of as the warning lights flashing on the dashboard, indicating that Americans are perhaps losing sight of why these difficult and extraordinary exertions are worth it in the first place.
Talking to Hal Brands and Charles Edel about historical memory, the risk of a new global catastrophe on the scale of World War II and many throughout history. Charles, let's focus on the cost side of things. You write in your piece that Americans are focused on the costs of the things that we've been doing to try to prevent a global catastrophe. So free trade sometimes risks economic dislocation, job loss here at home, military spending, loss of lives for American troops, maintaining global order. Make the case that it is worth those costs.
So the case has generally been made, or at least it was at the outset of this period, that it was worth paying a penny in to be penny-wise or pound foolish, right? That the idea would be that you would pay forward, that you would forward deploy U.S. troops, that you would have open trade associations and arrangements in order that you wouldn't have these conflicts growing later. So you would forward stage, permanently deploy United States military forces abroad as a dampener on conflict in Europe and in Asia that would otherwise grow larger. Is it expensive? Absolutely. But the argument had been made and was made persistently that permanently stationing U.S. forces abroad in many ways was cheaper than deploying them to those various regions when conflict spiked and spiraled in the first case.
Hal, I guess a question might be, why us? In 1946, sure, we were the only ones who could afford to do something like this in the United States after the devastation of World War II. Things are different in the 21st century. Can't the United States back away from this and let other parties step up?
So this is something that Americans have been tempted to do since the outset of the postal order. In fact, one of the statesmen that we most associate with the creation of the American world order, George Kennan, always hoped that there would come a time when the United States could pull back from the deployments and the exertions that Charles talked about and return to a more normal existence. The problem is that just because of the way that the world is configured in power and geopolitical terms, there really is no one else who can play this role. And so the fact is that the United States has proven uniquely capable of rallying other democratic nations to contain global disorder, in part because of its power, in part because of its geography makes us less threatening to countries in Europe and Asia than perhaps other countries are. And if you look around the world today and you ask yourself the question, what countries are most likely to pick up any geopolitical slack that the United States leaves if it pulls back from the scene? Unfortunately, it is unlikely to be the United Kingdom and France and Japan. It is likely to be the countries that have shown the most energy in undermining the international order over the past decade or so, so the Chinese and the Russians. And so I think that the urge to want to pull back and return to a more normal role is natural, but I think it would have devastating effects.
And Charles, in the piece, you point out that this is a difficult time on the world stage. What are the risks you see if the U.S. pulls out of its role around the world now?
I think what we had pointed to, and in fact what we see, is the lessening of American leadership, the increased concern of the United States' willingness to use its power to dampen some of those conflicts, as we've seen, points to exactly what Hal had just spoken about, namely that you have a growing sense of political power vacuums in both Europe and Asia, certainly. And with less of an ability and less certainly of a perception of U.S. willingness, I think you would see opportunistic authoritarian powers on both ends of that Eurasian landmass, Russia and China, continuing to probe at the periphery and further than that and test American power, undermine America's democratic allies in both of those regions. And I think the more that it looks like the United States will not check those revisionist powers, the more testing you are likely to see of that by both of those powers, if not others as well.
We're talking to Hal Brands and Charles Edel. In a new piece in Foreign Policy magazine, they say Americans have forgotten the experience of a major global catastrophe, something on the lines of a World War II, and they say that puts us at risk of a new international disaster.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the risk of another global catastrophe on the scale maybe of World War II? Do you think the United States should continue to play a leadership role in international affairs, even if it comes with a cost? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with Charles Edel and Hal Brands. They say Americans don't remember global tragedies on the scale of World War II, and that's leading the country to give up its leadership role, putting us at risk of a new global meltdown.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think the United States should keep its leadership role in international politics, be the first to intervene, try to help maintain the world economy? Do you think the costs are too high? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Hal, you mentioned a phrase, I think it was you mentioned the phrase earlier, warning lights flashing on the dashboard. What warning lights do you see around the world that our role could be tested as we're pulling back?
Well, I think there are a handful of things. So both Russia and China are essentially authoritarian great powers that are trying to exert primacy within their own geopolitical regions and are pushing against U.S.-led alliance systems to do so and are increasingly using outright force in the case of Russia or more subtle forms of coercion in the case of China in order to undermine U.S. alliance structures and shift geopolitical arrangements in East Asia or in Eastern Europe. I think we are also seeing what you might think of as problem states or rogue actors that are becoming more empowered and more dangerous. And so North Korea now has a sizable nuclear arsenal and is apparently working towards an intercontinental delivery capability that could eventually bring a nuclear weapon to the United States. Iran is coming out from international sanctions as it continues to push for influence in the Middle East. And so that category of challenges is growing as well. And then beyond that, there are the challenges that we are used to seeing over the past 25 years, but in some ways have gotten worse. And so the Islamic State, for instance, its military fortunes are on the decline now, but it has shown that non-state actors, non-state extremist groups can accumulate terrifying amounts of military power and can exert a really destabilizing influence on regions that are still important to the United States. So across these issues, the common thread is that the relative stability to which we've become accustomed, certainly over the past 25 years and really over the past 70 years, seems to be eroding.
Let's go to our callers now. Rick is on the line in Sun Prairie. Rick, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm enjoying this conversation. I'm certainly reminded of the famous George Santana quote, "Those who can't remember the past are doomed to repeat it." And I think the authors are onto something important here, but I have a question for them in regard to one of their comments. They had mentioned that one of the most important post-World War II policies of the United States was free trade, and that certainly has worked out well with the West, or even with Japan, for that matter, in the Marshall Plan with Europe. However, they also mentioned the emergent threat from the Chinese and the Russians. Those free trade policies of the Chinese, I would argue, were ill-advised for the reasons that the authors had mentioned, the fact that they're a totalitarian military dictatorship, and yet they're in the WTO, et cetera. My question to them would be, what should we have done differently in regard to the Chinese with trade policy, or what should we do going forward?
Rick, thanks for the call. Hal, do you want to take a crack at that?
Sure. I think Rick puts his finger on a very important dilemma, which is that over the past 25 years, the United States has pursued a two-pronged policy toward China. So on the one hand, we have sought to hedge against the possibility that China would behave aggressively by maintaining essentially military primacy in the Western Pacific. On the other hand, we've sought to maximize the possibility that China would become a satisfied, productive member of the international system by helping China develop its economy and integrating that economy into the broader global economy. And these were meant to be sort of the carrot and the stick. These things were supposed to go together. But what we've seen over the past decade certainly is that China has become much richer. It's become much more integrated into the international system, but it hasn't necessarily become more satisfied. It hasn't become more peaceful. And so now we confront the fact that these two prongs of our policy seem to be in tension with one another. I'm not sure that there was a dramatically different policy we could have pursued starting in the early 1990s. I think the one thing we might have done differently, with the benefit of hindsight, is to place greater conditionality upon China's entry into the international economy. And that would have taken the form of economic conditionality. So taking steps to make sure that China was not continuing to pursue mercantilist economic policies after it joined the WTO, for instance, but also political conditionality, and perhaps placing greater human rights conditionality or greater conditionality with respect to political liberalization on China's entry into the global economy. In retrospect, that might have been desirable.
Rick, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Tom with us in Eau Claire. Tom, hi. Tom, are you there? I don't think we have Tom. Tom's, in a nutshell, Tom's point, I think, was that we can't keep up this level of international spending along with all of the domestic spending needs that we have. We'll collapse if we try to juggle both of those needs. Charles, what do you think?
I think that Tom's question is a useful one because on the one hand, spending in order to keep us internationally engaged is not cheap, does not cost nothing. And as I think Tom rightly points out, our entitlement spending is not in stasis. In fact, it's rising and rising in a way that at some point is going to eclipse our other discretionary spending. However, a little historical perspective is useful here when we take a look at the discretionary military spending, for instance. On the one hand, our defense spending, when you look at it in real terms, is at and heading towards the lowest it's been in comparative terms since the beginning of World War II. This doesn't mean that we don't spend a lot. This doesn't mean that we don't spend more than the rest of the world combined, as people like to point out frequently. But this also should show us that historically, even over this past 72 years that we're talking about, we are spending almost at a historically low point as the threats seem to be proliferating and diversifying, meaning that we might want to think about where those would scale upwards. In fact, you know, the sequestration of the defense budget, which was the agreement that everyone made but that nobody liked under the Obama administration, held that we were going to indiscriminately keep defense spending at a flat line. We now have a budget moving forward for the first time in many years, but this doesn't mean that defense spending can't come up. But Tom points, I think, rightly to a major issue here that unless we are willing to grapple with some other larger economic budget items like entitlement spending, there will be a squeeze at some point on this.
Well, as we start to wrap up, Hal, I want to ask, is it inevitable that we're going to have another major international catastrophe like World Wars I and II or the 30 Years' War, or you refer to the Peloponnesian War? Is this just a cycle of history that's going to happen, or is there something we can do about it?
I don't think it's inevitable at all. In fact, I think what the past 70 years have shown is that if we pursue enlightened policies, difficult as they are, we can restrain the forces that have traditionally led to these global crackups. But the question is, will we continue to pursue the policies? And I don't think there's any inherent reason why the United States, together with its allies, cannot continue playing the constructive role today that we have played for the past 70 years. The United States and its allies still control a clear majority of global wealth and military spending. We still make up the largest combined power bloc in the world by a significant degree. And so ultimately, I think the issue is as much one of willpower as it is of power. It's the question of whether we are going to rouse ourselves to continue pursuing time-tested policies or whether we are going to forget why we've done this in the first place and retreat to a policy that might be more comforting in the short term but will probably be quite damaging over the long term.
And briefly, Charles, given the support for Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump from different viewpoints, but skepticism of free trade, skepticism of American involvement around the world, do you think that will is there in American politics?
I think the jury is out on this one. I think in many ways we've seen that the consensus, such as it was, on America's leading international role has frayed. And I think there's no doubt that the past election illuminated that for us kind of on left and right. On the other hand, American support for its international role, for its alliance system, for being internationally engaged is by no means, a minority-held position. It's one that is contested and is being contested in a very public way from the White House, even. But I don't think that there is a sense yet that the American people are ready to go home and return to a role that precludes American internationalism and leadership.
Thanks to both of our guests, Charles Edel from U.S. Naval War College and Hal Brands from Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. We've been talking about their piece in Foreign Policy. It's linked on the Central Time Facebook page. They wrote about the risks of a future international catastrophe and the United States leadership role in the world. Share your thoughts and check out their piece on the Central Time Facebook page.
If you're in a hurry today, maybe take a minute to slow down and saunter for just a little bit.
Today is National Sauntering Day, created back in the 1970s to get us to slow down and wander around aimlessly. It was created by Bill Rabe, who also invented the annual Banished Words List that's a regular feature here on WPR every year around New Year's.
He created the day in reaction to the jogging craze of the 1970s, where jogging was faster, more focused, and goal-oriented. Sauntering is slow and mellow and kind of pointless.
And I guess people were wearing tight running shorts. He said, no, sauntering. If you're going to go out and saunter, you got to wear loose-fitting clothing, apparently. Are you a fan of sauntering?
There's always a place for sauntering, isn't there?
Yeah, sometimes I am a fast walker sometimes. And, you know, when I'm out walking with people, I have to slow down.
You do tend to scamper.
Scamper's a strong word. but it is nice to get out and saunter, or maybe a mosey. I'm not sure what the difference would be there.
No, I think, isn't there an Italian tradition? I'm probably going to get it wrong and get corrected. Passeggiata, where after dinner, you walk around slowly, saunter with the family, and you greet other people. That tradition, I think, is lovely. I think maybe we should have a built-in saunter.
And greet other people.
Other people.
Well, that's so crazy, it just might work.
Mm-hmm.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.